Killer City. That's one of the more dubious nicknames that Kansas City has garnered over the years. No one asks how we got it anymore. Almost daily, Kansas City sees these dark hours, these senseless acts of violence and inhumane killings. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll talk about the devastating toll of the seemingly never-ending spree of homicides that plague our city. We'll hear from the deputy chief of the KCPD and leaders from local crime groups, including community activist Alvin Brooks. Plus, we get to the heart of the matter with an urban businessman who reflects on a rather chilling tale of his employee being killed in his own barbershop. How do we make it stop? Is it even possible to turn things around in 2012? We'll try to answer some of those questions ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. The grim murder statistics in 2011 in Kansas City, Missouri, easily top 2010, with an average of two killings per week. One of those victims is Joseph Jackson, who worked a mere two chairs from where I used to get my haircut and where my oldest son got his haircut, at Barbershop 67 on Troost near 34th Street. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joe, as he was known, was as affable and courteous as any barber you could ever meet. The murder of Joseph Jackson and more than 100 others raised plenty of questions and not enough answers for many in the community, especially for the barbershop's owner, Craig Carlock. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Alvin Brooks, an activist and founder of the ad hoc group Against Crime, and KCPD Deputy Chief Randall Hunley, as well as Richard Easley, president on the board for Kansas City's Metropolitan Crime Commission. But first, Barbershop 67's owner, Craig Carlock, who joins us now. Craig not only lost an employee, but a friend. In fact, my own barber, Vanessa, quit out of sheer grief, and Craig Carlock looks to pick up the pieces. He joins us now on Central Standard. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Thank you very much.
How are you holding up in the wake of this terrible tragedy?
It's very tough. You deal with the emotions from losing a friend, losing someone that you actually work with. And then you also deal with the aftermath of that, which is the actual business itself. You know, what is the viability of it? There's not a really script of how you deal with something like this. So you're just kind of trying to, you know, stumble your way through.
Tell us about Joe and how his friends and family and colleagues have attempted to make sense of his killing and move on and heal.
I really can't speak much about Joe's family because I really didn't know them that well. But I can say that, Joe was able to, work in the actual barber profession for, around 20 years or so. And, I think that with every barber or every stylist, they always think in the back of their mind that something like this could possibly happen. I think that friends and family of the people that are in this kind of business also think of that as well, but you just don't expect it to actually happen. The brief interaction that I had with them, it was very tough, for them. I would imagine that it's, crushing.
Where were you when you found out about the murder of Joseph Jackson?
I was at home. Vanessa called me. She was called by one of the local residents. And, they told her that they weren't sure, but that we needed to, get to the shop. Something had apparently happened. And from there, I just, gathered myself, gathered my things, and I was on the way, to the shop. I certainly, while on the way to the shop, had no idea that, what I was going to, see. But, but it was almost like of it's kind of like an out-of-body experience in a way. You know, it's what you see on TV. It's not what you expect to experience, you know, personally.
Craig, you opened the shop to invest in essentially an impoverished neighborhood, a dangerous neighborhood. But did you envision it, the barbershop, as a safe zone sort of when you opened?
Oh, definitely. You know, I'm an urban kid, you know, grew up here in Kansas City, in and around the 39th and Indiana area. So my idea was to invest in the urban area. You know, a lot of times people talk about, you know, wanting to make a positive impact, but it doesn't go beyond the words. Well, I wanted to create a place that was comfortable for, you know, mothers, you know, because mothers are, you know, tend to be the primary caregivers now for like many of our young men. And then we have seniors that also have some of the same concerns. They want to go to a place where they feel comfortable. And that was a goal. But I also wanted a place, too, that folks could, you know, within the community could, you know, look at it and be proud that this exists in their neighborhood, and with the hopes of helping to show others that the things that they may read and hear about the community are not always true. You know, urban living is just like suburban living. It's not that one's better. It's just that people have a particular choice. And there are some folks that choose urban living. And by choosing urban living, that should not mean that you have to have a sub, you know, standard quality, you know, when it comes to businesses and services.
Given your intentions in opening this barbershop and given what happened, what does the murder of a barber in his 50s, in the age of the 50s range, say about the lack of human respect for the more sacred spaces historically in the black community, such as a barbershop? You mentioned the prevalence of seniors, the prevalence of mothers. What does it say that a murder like this can happen in a place like that?
I think it says a lot of things, and I'll start with the negative things first. You know, I think negatively, I think it says that pretty much that no place happens to be out of like bounds for someone that, you know, wants to create, you know, mayhem, you know, someone that wants to take something they really don't care, you know, where that is. They don't care who they're going to take it from. When it happens in a place such as a barbershop, a salon, or, you know, God forbid, a church, where we've seen some of those things around the country, it really lets you know that that no matter what precautions that you try to take on your own, that if someone's will is to do something such as this, you're really, you know, at bay, because there's not much you can do.
Indeed, 2011 was a volatile year for stuff that touched me on both sides. You talked about a church. My church was actually shot up at a funeral earlier in the year. And now you have this incident at the barbershop. What's different about the violence these days, Craig, from the time you grew up?
Wow. You know, I've had, you know, many like conversations, you know, about what has happened. And I've tried to temper it with, you know, when you have a collision, you know, between anger and like helplessness, sometimes you may say or you may do things that that you regret. But, you know, but I'm going to say this, and I hope that people will understand this. My personal opinion is that I kind of think that we have, you know, allowed a sort of like savagery style of, you know, lifestyle in a way. I'm not saying that anyone is necessarily endorsing it, but I do believe that what has happened in our society is that we have those that, if you're going to steal, it used to be where someone would just take what they wanted and then they would move on. Now, I'm certainly not saying that that was best, but if the choice is take what you want and then, you know, hurt or even kill the one that you're taking from, certainly I would prefer the person to just take and then move on. But I think in today's world, it's almost like, you know, I will take what I want and then I will destroy whatever happens to be in and even around. And, you know, when I say this, I'm not this is not race-based, this is just people-based. And then it's not just within Kansas City, it's not just within the U.S. I think we're talking about, you know, around the world. But and I think that that what happened within the shop, that the difficult part that I deal with is that I wanted to create a place that was absent of that type of behavior, and for it to be, and for it not to only occur, but to occur inside, it really hurts.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. We're talking about Kansas City crime and violent homicides, and how, according to our guest, no place seems safe anymore. We're talking to Craig Carlock, an urban businessman whose barbershop was the scene of a murder. When did you arrive at the decision to keep the shop open in light of that incident?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. At this moment, I'm not really even at that particular point, because, you know, one of the things that the biggest battle ahead is to, you know, try to attract barbers that are able to look beyond, you know, something like this. And I know that that's asking a lot. You know, many people have said, you know, well, Craig, this could have happened anywhere. And I will nod in like agreeance. But the only difference is that it didn't. So, you know, trying to sell the shop to a potential barber was already difficult before. And this makes it, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 times even harder. So I really can't say, you know, how that will work out.
Is it particularly frustrating, Craig? You did take the proper precautions. You had the shop set up pretty tight even before the murder. Doors with buzzers, no cut, no hanging out, no enter policy. What would change after something like this, if anything? How does it possibly get tighter than that?
You know, I really can't say that it really can be. You know, some people that have, you know, really had that have tried to be helpful and have tried to be supportive, you know, they've, you know, ask, well, could you have a security guard or something like that? And I think that, you know, I'm not sure that people would really feel comfortable coming into a barbershop or into a...
that needed an arm.
Right, exactly. And it's just the type of business where, you know, some that look, you know, would probably be more of a deterrent to law-abiding customers than it would be. So I really don't know. That's also another part of the, you know, some of the guilt that I kind of have had to deal with as well, is that, you know, could I have done enough? Did you do enough? And rationally thinking, you know, sure, I think I did try, and I think I did about the best I could. But then there's the other part of you that, because of the emotional tie, you know, you still question.
I mentioned that my own personal barber quit. I was a patron of the shop. It's very rare that you would actually be this close to a story. I'm very close to it. How is Vanessa? Have you spoken to her since this incident, since she quit over the incident? She mentioned to me over the phone that she could have been there that fateful night. She wasn't in that good of shape when I talked to her. How's she doing?
You know, one of the, of all the negative things that have come, you know, from this, you know, one of them has been those that, you know, her working side by side with Joe. And on that particular day, or that particular evening, she just happened to not be there. And it was difficult for her to be able to deal with the what if. You know, what if I were there? Would it have happened? Would it not have happened? You know, what if I were there? You know, would it have happened? I mean, throughout the 2.5 years of being there, I've been in and out of the shop and early in the morning, late at night, you know, as well. So, you know, but with Vanessa, you know, because she worked in there with them side by side, I can only imagine the, you know, emotions that she has gone through. You know, one of the things that I did tell her, although I would have, you know, certainly from a business perspective would have wanted her to stay, I did tell her that I understood that it could be difficult for her to stay. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that a couple of days after, you know, we actually were open a little bit, and, you know, Vanessa, you know, did work, and I think it was on pure like adrenaline, you know, doing without thinking per se. And we had a long discussion, but, you know, she just said that it would, that she didn't believe that she could, you know, come back. And like I said, I totally understood that.
And of course you have the same challenge for your patrons as well.
Exactly.
As well as yourself. I could have been there. What could have happened? I got my hair cut several times, two right. chairs from where Joe Station was. Right. So even as a patron, you wonder, what if?
Right.
What happens now, Craig?
And, you know, what happens now? Part of me has you know, felt like, wow, you know, well, now you got to think about the business side. But are you that? But because you're moving so quickly over to the business side, are you not taking care of the human side, you know, as much? So there's always that, you know, tug. But I'm just taking it a day at a time, trying to, you know, look at, because at the end of the day, it still has to be an actual business decision. You know, how long can I be down before, you know, before I may have to shutter the, you know, doors.
We've been talking with Craig Carlock, who owns Barbershop 67 on Troost near 34th Street, the scene of an unfortunate murder of one of the barbers there. And we're talking about violence in the community and Craig now picking up the pieces as the new year begins. Happy New Year, Craig.
All right. Thank you very much.
And good luck.
Same to you. Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue talking about violent crime and homicides with some of our city leaders. We'll be joined by KCPD Deputy Chief Randall Hunley, community activist and former Mayor Pro Tem Alvin Brooks, and Richard Easley, president on the board of Kansas City's Metropolitan Crime Commission. That's all ahead when we return. And welcome back to Central Standard. Violence has gotten so bad in Kansas City, Missouri, it seems that the death toll has inspired rather risque, bordering on tasteless jokes among critics. The blog, for instance, Joko SOB, handicaps the 2012 death toll, saying it will reach 112, setting that number at over or under, as if it's Vegas, as if people's lives are worth betting on. This is how bad things have gotten for cynical reactions like that. Joining us now to discuss what certainly isn't a laughing matter is Randall Hunley, Deputy Chief of the KCPD, Alvin Brooks, a community legend and former mayor pro tem and founder of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, sits on a whole bunch of boards addressing community issues such as this, and Richard Easley, president of the board of the Kansas City Metropolitan Crime Commission. Welcome to Central Standard, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with Deputy Chief Hunley. The violence has touched many in the urban core personally, as we just heard, including Chief Daryl Forte himself, whose friend was murdered in 2011. What's the new strategy that you and he and the department have outlined going into 2012 to maybe keep murder rates down? The short version.
The short version is... just trying to put more officers and more intelligence on the street to gather more information. As always, we try to build trust and support from the community and get more community interaction involved in trying to solve crimes and prevent crimes.
You talk about building trust and support. Trust and support are among the sort of obstacles in some investigations that hinder proper investigations, particularly when you're dealing with murder. Would you say that's true?
Sure it is, especially when you're dealing with incidents like that, that people are unfamiliar with what goes on during the course of an investigation. You have to have people willing to come forward with information to help us to solve the crime and arrest the offenders.
Let's bring in Alvin Brooks. Mr. Brooks, you've been an officer and mayor pro tem and a community activist. What needs to be done differently from the community standpoint this year with its interaction with police officers and investigators?
Well, I think police has set the stage for that by the chief, as soon as he took office, was sworn in, indicated that improving the relationship between the police and the community was one of his top priorities. And I think the communities should respond to that by doing everything that it can to make sure that it reporting crimes, being willing to be witnesses, being willing to join with the police in this effort from a broad cross-section of the community, not just one section, but I mean a business, a faith community, individuals, families. We need to teach our young people how to respect police and also come forward and point people out and be willing to go to court and be a witness.
Mr. Brooks, with statistics are increasingly showing minority victims disproportionately. 2011, for instance, was almost more than 80% minority deaths in terms of the murders when you add Latinos to the mix of African-American men and African-American women. What is the community's first role? What should be the first role of the community in 2012 in closing ranks and preventing some of this?
Well, first of all, there ought to be an outrage, and it has not been. I mean, it's in certain sections, but overall, you don't hear a hue and cry for why this is happening, what we're going to do to improve it, what we're going to do to support the police, what we're going to do as far as encouraging people to come forward and letting people, those that commit crimes and prey upon our very being, that's unacceptable behavior. That has not taken place, and that troubles a number of us, certainly troubles me that's not occurring. And I think that's got to occur. Plus, I think we have to look internally in terms of our families. Many of these crimes are generational. The father is in prison or has been a murder victim. The mother's on the streets or single heads of household. And let me hasten to say, in all of these cases, the mothers are not on the street. Mothers are struggling trying to be mother and father in many of these homes. And so I think that we've got to continue to give support to those single heads of household, those mothers who are heading those households, support them. Education is one of the keys, and that's long range. But I think that's what the community has to do. It has to wrap its arms around those families, and where there's generational violence, generational drug abuse, generational gang activity, I think that we have to work with the police to curb that. We're not going to stamp it out, but we can certainly make a dent in it, I think, with full cooperation from everyone.
Mr. Brooks, let's bring in one of your fellow board members, Richard Easley, the president on the board of the Kansas City Metropolitan Crime Commission. Mr. Easley, you had 31 years with the KCPD. What is your take on why some police are saying the community is not as cooperative as it should be in some of these murder cases? What's your take on that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that crime fighting is a team effort, Jay. It's something that the police department or individual in the blue uniform cannot solve most crimes. We need some support from the community to be able to do that. And I think it's so critical that we work closely not only with the community organizations, community leaderships, with organizations like Ad Hoc, other organizations in our neighborhoods to be able to solve crimes, because it's a team effort.
When does the policing get beyond stats, Deputy Chief Hundley, and more into tactical measures, and how do you balance the two?
Well, I'm currently assigned to Investigations Bureau, so I am the reactionary part right now that I respond, my bureau members respond to investigate and identify the suspects and what have you. So that is our primary function. But, you know, of course, you have patrol, and that's the day-to-day out in the field trying to deter crime. You know, it's really important for people to self-police themselves and to, you know, follow the rules, follow the law, and do what they're supposed to do. So, but, yeah, my job is to respond when an incident has occurred and figure out who did it.
you're not obviously thinking about the stats. You're actually in the trenches investigating the crimes as they happen, working on preventative measures. But politically, stats are what we see when we look at the right. death toll and the clearance rates and the arrest rates. So how do you get beyond that in your capacity as deputy chief, working with deputy Chief Forte?
Well, stats, and as my professor says, you can make stats do anything you want them to do. But stats are important because at the end, those statistics are what we're held accountable for. People look at that and, you know, either complain about it or praise it. So, yes, stats are important. It shows it's a measuring stick to show how well we are doing our job and what have you. That statistic, we use that to measure it, but the bottom line is we want to bring comfort, resolution, closure to those families and to identify that suspect to get him off the street so he can no longer, you know, commit this crime against other people.
And Richard Easley, how are you bringing that community bridge of the investigative aspect and the reluctance among community members to come forward? How are you working on bringing that bridge with the commission?
Well, certainly we work very closely with all the media outlets to make sure that individuals in the community know how they can get in touch with us. We think that is so critical. And when you call the Crime Stopper Tips Hotline, 474-TIPS, rest assured we don't have caller ID. It's totally anonymous. We are not the slightest bit interested in who you are, your race, your sex. What we're interested in is the information that you have and being able to gather that information and funnel it to the law enforcement agency where the crime has been committed. And then what we do is work with that agency, and they let us know if that information leads to an arrest. So we work very closely with all of the law enforcement agencies in the metro area. And also work with news outlets, community organizations to get information out about how we're available anonymously for you to provide information that you know about crimes that have been committed.
Mr. Brooks, even with the most wanted newspapers and the Crime Stoppers Tips hotlines and the efforts among the police departments, commissions, and rank and file members as well as officials there, you still have the Stop Snitching campaigns, you still have a layer of mistrust. How do you adjust that over at ad hoc?
Well, first of all, we certainly encourage in cases where there's a possibility of the suspect being known. And many times in these families, the family members know who the suspect is. And I think what we have to do is encourage them to come forward and deal with that. Also, I think the police department and community groups coming together, saying this over and over again to people. And there's another part of this. There's a prosecutor's office that represents the people in court in these kind of cases. And, of course, the prosecutor's office got to be a part of that to give some assurance, at least as much as they can, to the fact that we'll do everything we can to support you. In this system of ours, you have a right to confront your accuser, the constitutional right to do that. So except in cases of young people, that courts in many cases had not been struck down, have been able to just use a video or a sound bites, if you will, of the child's testimony. So I think all this comes in together. We just have to do a better job of educating the community. As some people are saying, well, here I just this week, Deputy Chief Huntley remembers I sent some information where this woman has said, well, I'm looking up and seeing the person out on the street all the time. But the truth of the matter is that the police department is aware of the person, looking for the person. But someone out there has got to say, here she is, or here he is. And
say it in court.
Well, no, they don't have to come to court in that kind of case. They're not a witness. All they're doing is telling where the suspect
to lead
is,
the
or the person of interest is.
To lead
the
apprehension.
Yes, which
makes me want to turn to you, Deputy Chief Hunley. How do you feel the whole chain of due process works? Alvin Brooks mentions the prosecutor. The whole chain of due process, once you've apprehended a suspect, once you've built the case, once you've handed that case to the prosecutor, yeah, you're smiling. How does that whole process work? How has that been effective in getting murderers off the street, preventing more murderers from becoming murderers, and sending murderers to jail?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the prosecutor's office. All I can say is
I didn't ask you to. We identified
the suspects. We put the case file together, and we forwarded it over to the prosecutor's office in hopes that charges will be filed and the person will be held until brought to court, because if they've committed a murder, they don't need to be out in the street. So, we do our part, and, you know, my prior deputy chief used to always say, stay in your lane. And so that's what I do. I stay in my lane. I do the part that I'm commissioned to do, and then I let and hope that the justice system completes the part that it's supposed to do.
Richard Easley, how do you feel about that line of due process sitting on a relatively independent commission?
Well, certainly we like to see as many convictions as we can get. But I think that something came to mind as Deputy Chief Hunley was talking about. I know Chief Forte recently, and it's in the development stages, put together a community outreach program to focus on victims and their families, a place that they can go and call the police department and get some answers if they have questions about what's happening with their individual case, which may be at the prosecutor's office. It may be under investigation. And also they have available resources for those families and the victims that they can make referrals for them. So I think that's a huge positive step that Chief Forte has undertaken there.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Violent crime, murder prevention, investigations, the chain of due process, the toll of violence among families. Those are the heavy topics we're discussing today on Central Standard. Our guests are Randall Hunley, the deputy chief of the KCPD, Alvin Brooks, longtime activist and former mayor pro tem, founder of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, Richard Easley, president on the board of the Kansas City Metropolitan Crime Commission. Kansas City, what's your solution for stemming the tide of violence in the metro? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're also available on Facebook on the 89.3 KCUR page and Twitter at KCURCST. Leslie on Facebook says, the key to me, the key to her, is planting the seed of hope in our young children and nurturing that through their lifetime. Without hope, they won't care about the lives of others. We must show them that they can do great things and encourage them to dream and pursue those dreams. Greg on Twitter says something along those lines, improve educational and economic opportunities. Deputy Chief Hunley, what do you feel about some of these comments, and how do you round all of these esoteric things into crime prevention?
Those are good starting points, and they're right on, because the family is an important part in educating and teaching people how to behave and deal with frustration and anger management and conflict resolution and once again, self-policing, so that when you are faced with a situation, you won't overreact and do something in a spur of the moment, in the heat of the moment, that would affect your life.
Mr. Brooks, you got some interesting reading there with the paper rattling of the most wanted crime members of
I was looking at some of the faces.
Do you recognize some of those faces?
Well, not yet. I haven't gone through the paper. But let me. I think your two persons that text something to you, tweeted something to you, are right on target. I think that's true. There's another phase of this that we haven't gotten into also is the length of time that it takes to bring someone to trial.
Right.
And that's not a fault of the prosecutor's office. It's a fault of the system. The system's overcrowded. And this county and probably the city of St. Louis is in this, as relates to the state of Missouri, have the longest waiting period before someone probably comes to court. Smaller counties, then you commit a murder, a rape, a robbery, any violent crime, you'll go to court probably that same year. Here it may be 2 years, maybe longer than that. And here this whole thing is festering. And plus, there's a feeling on the part of the family of the victim and the community, too, that justice is delayed. As far as justice delayed, justice denied. And so I think that and I know the new prosecutor, Jane Peters Baker, is trying to speed that process up. But when you got a county like ours and the city of St. Louis with a large number of violent crimes in the number of persons who are working, those assistant prosecutors in those two cities, there's a problem. And the citizens don't understand that. So we've got to do a better job of saying, hey, this is the way the system works. It's not fair in terms of how you feel about it, but that's the way the system works. And so I just wanted to throw that in because that is a real concern on the part of family members who've been victimized by violent crimes.
Richard Easley, you have this sort of duplicitous oxymoronic thing where the citizens want action, but action is slow, but at the same time, other citizens maybe aren't willing to step forward. How do you deal with that sort of pea soup?
Well, I mean, I think we deal with it through encouragement, through the media, as well as personal contacts we have in community organizations. And I know we get referrals from the PD. And, Jay, I don't want everybody to get the impression that the TIPS hotline is the only program we have at the Crime Commission. Not only are we trying to catch violent felons, fugitives, but we also have a reentry program called Second Chance. Every year, 3,000 ex-offenders come back into our community, and they're rated in three categories. And the high-risk category is Area 3. And what we do at the Crime Commission is we have 120 member coalition of organizations that help individuals kind of transition back into the community and find that hope and maybe find those resources that will help them get a job and also a place to stay. So we work very hard to help individuals who truly want to make a change in their life, want to come back in the community and be productive. So we do have that program available also, which hopefully does provide hope and some opportunity for success, which we think is so important.
Celia in Raytown, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question, but I wanted to give a little background about myself. I sit on the board of Reconciliation Services, which is located on Troost and works with folks who slip through the cracks. And so we deal with sometimes the homeless population, but also single women who have families, and in other words, a variety of situations. And as we've worked with these folks, we realize that trauma both for victims as well as trauma in the families of the perpetrators, is something that is ongoing. And if it's not healed, then this is perpetuated. So my question today is that something that's looked at? Do you look at trauma? Is there counseling available? Are you dealing with just individuals, or is it done with families? That's basically my question.
Thank you for your question, Celia. A very poignant question from Celia. Trauma.
Yeah, and I think that the ministries there at 31st and Truth, that she's taught, does a great job, Father David and others that are involved in that. Yes, the one organization, the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, of which I'm a part of, we're working with families who've been victimized by homicide, and we do prayer vigils. Last year I spoke at 23 funerals a year before. In 2010, I spoke at 41. I don't like to speak at funerals of homicide victims, and I say that because it takes its toll on me sometimes. But I continue to do it. But I think that meeting with those families, we have a support group that, in fact, we just met this Tuesday and with the support group, and we have from a dozen to 50, 60 persons present. And so dealing with the whole issue of trauma, how do you cope? And so it's difficult because it needs to be an ongoing relationship that you have with family, especially mothers and sometimes younger siblings. So that is in place. And then there's a number of other agencies around that also have how to cope sessions or sessions on dealing with grief.
And I'll piggyback and add that Chief Easley earlier stated, Chief Forte has created a new division in my bureau, the Community Support Division. Doug Wisher is in charge of that. And what we are doing is expanding our victim advocate to provide resources not only to victims but also to just resources to victims and their family members to help either financially or with counseling or referring them to other areas. And we're looking throughout the nation to see how other programs are, how effective they are. A couple of my people are going to go to Denver, Colorado, and Colorado Springs here next week to view their system because they have a very nice system that provides those resources.
You know, I think, if I might, that's important also that the police as well as the prosecutor keep in contact with families. I mean, in the case of the police, where the case is unsolved, in the case of the prosecutor, where the case has been really solved and sent to the prosecutor a number of times, people that helps relieve to some degree the grief that they're going through, to know that, first of all, that the case is still being pursued, and on the other hand, that it will be prosecuted to the fullest and do everything they can to get a conviction. So I think that's part of that whole grieving process also.
Deputy Chief Hunley, 30 homicides are unsolved, according to statistics holdover from 2011. Without mentioning the specific cases or getting into the nuances of the specific cases, how are those things handled along the lines of what Alvin Brooks is talking about here in terms of keeping in touch with the family, letting them know that the case is still being worked, keeping in touch with the prosecutor, keeping the lines of communication open to solve some of these homicides?
Right. The unsolved homicides are still assigned to detectives, and they continue to work those regardless. So especially like right now when we don't have any fresh homicides, those detectives are still working those cases, still trying to follow up leads if they have any and everything to try to solve those. They take them personally. They work really hard. They want to solve the case. Once it's assigned to them, they take ownership of it. And so they work it until it goes cold. And then anytime additional information is revealed or forwarded to us, then they look into it. After 3 years, it'll transfer over to the cold case squad, and then it is systematically reviewed in years and patterns.
Years and patterns. Welcome to Central Standard, Phil.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good.
All right. Just to give a little background about myself, I'm a volunteer at Operation Breakthrough, located at 31st and Troost in Kansas City. And there's a lot of great work that goes on down there. And I just wanted to say that the increase in the homicide rate, a terrible tragedy. And as Kansas Cityans, none of us want to see that. But I feel personally that, you know, it's indicative of a symptom of something that's wrong with the inherent structure of things that are underlying the atmosphere that, you know, we as individuals participate in on an everyday basis. And instead of treating the symptoms, what we need to do is treat the underlying disease.
And what are those symptoms, Phil, before you continue? What are those symptoms?
Well, I'd say the increase in the homicide rate increases in, I guess, the number of unemployment. Basically, what I'm saying is that since, I guess, Missouri high schools really have lost their accreditation and that there's a number of problems in the Kansas City school system, we don't really present that many opportunities to people to, how can I put this, succeed in lives that they feel that they're making a positive influence and that they can realize financial rewards from that. Instead, what really in my mind goes on is that there's a message propagated by, I don't know, you could call it music, the mass media, or something else that really encourages people to seek, shall we say, an easy way out and to participate in things that are totally negative to society. And in my view, really what we have to do is we have to educate the children and the youth to be contributing members of a society that they themselves want to participate in, rather than, I guess, making it this bleak world where people don't have that many resources available to them, and thus they'll do, shall we say, seedy things in order to make a living for themselves. Basically, what I'm proposing is that we educate and we treat each other with respect in order so that these problems don't occur. I mean, there will be psychopaths and people out there who, you know, just might have a screw loose and do violent things, but I prefer to think that, you know, sometimes people are just put in situations, and if we could find them a way to get out of those situations in a better manner, then they would take that way as opposed to the short route. Does that?
That makes sense, Phil. Thank you for those comments. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Violent crime and murder prevention and investigation are the topics of today's show. Our guests are Randall Hunley, the deputy police chief of the KCPD, Alvin Brooks, founder of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and Richard Easley, president on the board of the Kansas City Metropolitan Crime Commission. Mr. Brooks, along the lines of what our last caller was saying, delaying gratification, particularly in terms of armed robbery, drug sales, things of that matter, delaying the gratification, feeling that there's no other economic opportunity. Is he on to something with that?
He's on to something. And the thing of it is that there is certainly a correlation between education. The only way to deal with that is through education that reduces poverty, reduces crime and violence. If you find where you've got an uneducated and a miseducated population, you're going to have high crime, violence, and that kind of thing. And I think just this morning it's been announced that from the Department of Education at the national level, that Kansas City is one of the worst, if not the worst, school district in the country. Now that is something, my God, when I heard that this morning, it struck me. And so I think any of the cities that have a high crime rate, regardless of the race or the ethnicity of the people, if those young folks, especially the males, and in our case, the African-American males, who are being kicked out, pushed out, dropped out, whatever kind of out they're not in, you can be sure, you can predict that there's going to be the violent crime. So the caller and the previous caller, a texter or Twitter, that's one of the keys. Now, that's the long range because you can't educate young folks overnight. But I think what we have to do is set up alternatives. I know there's a lot of opposition sometimes to charter schools, but some of them are doing a good job, some of them better than the public schools. But I think all of these together, the community has to look at this. I mean, this is not just an inner city and urban problem. This is an American dilemma, and therefore this whole metropolitan area ought to be concerned about 17,000 kids and too many of them not being educated. And that's why you have the high crime rate. That's it. You're going to continue to have it as long as you have folks who are impoverished, folks who live day to day and don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, so they live their best day to day. I think that's part of the issue that we face in Kansas City and across this country.
Richard Easley. Along those lines of what he's saying, the perceptions, this being an American problem, not just a Kansas City problem, how do we help allay the perception that most of these killings are happening in one or two zip codes on the east side of Kansas City, somewhere in a violent, third world-like corner that doesn't really touch the rest of the city, and therefore it's not the rest of the city's problems? How do we get beyond that perception?
You know, I think we all have a responsibility to be a crime fighter, and I don't think it makes any difference if you live north of the river, south of the river, on the east side. And I think that, we've got to focus our attention, all of us, on trying to help make our neighborhoods a better place to live, raise your family, and for the businesses that need to come in and provide the jobs to be able to make the neighborhood much more productive than it is. I think it takes a huge team effort, and both our callers have been right on in their vision of what the problem is. And I think we all struggle from time to time with the nuts and bolts of how to solve all those major social issues that we brought up. And of course, Mr. Brooks is right on with his comments about the school and education, and behind every victim and victim's family out there, and even behind every individual that commits a crime, are a lot of youngsters that need some positive role model and need some support.
Deputy Chief Hunley, how can the whole community get involved to help prevent murders and be vigilant against violence in the metro, even if it doesn't affect them directly?
Well, as was just stated, some of the youth, we have to keep the youth active and with positive activities and things like that. And then while we're, you know, I grew up being involved in sports year-round, whether it's basketball, football, baseball. If you keep them involved in doing active, positive things, then they don't have time to do the negative things and be involved in the negative things that result in homicides.
Isn't then a resource issue? Is it then a resource issue in terms of creating these police athletic leagues, these Boys and Girls Clubs, funding for those events, after-school events, educational positive events?
You know, you got so many after-school events, and you got the PAL centers, you got the Boys and Girls Club. You know, you have the different community centers. These kids are very resourceful. When they want to do something, they get to what they wear and what they want to do. We just need to make sure the doors are open for them to be there, and I would hope that no one is turned away. So it's about just keeping them involved in positive activities.
Alvin Brooks, how do you keep those doors open, literally and figuratively?
Well, I think what the chief has said here, the deputy chief has said, is the way that you go about that. But at the same time, I think that we've got a number of our larger congregations that have places that could provide opportunities for young people in particular. I want to go back, if I might just, I know that we're pretty much out of time, but I'd like to go back that one of the things that we've found helpful is, in what we do at the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, is in working with these families, that also working with particularly the African-American males in those families who, because of the feeling that their sibling has been murdered, that they're going to retaliate, and working with them to try to keep that from taking place and on an ongoing basis, because they're very, very at risk to become victim or perpetrators themselves.
We've talked to Aim for Peace about that. That information is on centralstandard.org and kcur.org for those who are interested in listening to that. Our guests are Alvin Brooks, founder of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, also former Mayor Pro Tem, Randall Hunley, deputy chief at the KCPD, and Richard Easley, president on the board of the Kansas City Metropolitan Crime Commission. Thank you for joining me, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with co-host Monroe Dodd. This show was produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our regular producer is Andrea Salenzi. Central Standard's executive producer is Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Muter manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. What you're hearing right now is composed by the Wilnots. Up to Date is next with a conversation about The Gothic Imagination, a new book that explores classic works in horror and suspense. Not to keep you in horror or suspense, I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.